approach. Maybe it works for them, but I'm very much, I very much use my intuition and my empirical findings. And you can mess about with data all the time. There are people who love to code and never love to go outside too, so they don't really have a good empirical or personal sense of what's going out there. And I realize that there's this dance that I do between objectivity and subjectivity, and you make observations in the field, and you're always vulnerable to taking your subjective impressions and running away with them. So that's why I run tests to support them or negate them.
Thank you. That just helps me.
Is that the right thing to do? I don't know
that there's right or wrong. I
think people who are driven excessively by the data tend to get really boxed in. You know, I like talking to people who are creative and try novel ways of thinking about things. So whatever works, you know. Anyway, this is my CSV file. For the heat plot. So we have a timestamp, we have a site ID, you've got the latitude, or we've got the XY coordinates, and then we have all the parameters here. So it's pretty easy to model these parameters with, say, we can match this data frame, we can cobble this data frame together by merging it with some of the fish data and say, well, here are the conditions at these different sites along the slough, and do they match, you know, how do they pair up with fish conditions?
Yeah, have you done any, like, the heat plot with then fish on the alternate axis?
No, I haven't done that yet. That would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Or CPUE.
Yeah, that would be really fun. Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with it, right? Looking at trends across the top of the axis, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the fun stuff.
They do that with the salmon temperature model.
Uh-huh.
That those dots with the reds and the temperature.
Right, that's right.
That would be really useful.
Yeah, that would be cool here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. So then, you know, for my own internal use, I actually, the heat plots are a start, the heat maps are a start, but then just plotting lines is really important for me, and I don't think that's very useful for the public, you know, unless you're, you know, if you just want a snapshot of what's going on with water quality, you look at the heat map, you know. If you want to look at it over time, you look at the heat plots. For me, to do the analysis, I want to look at, you know, lines. So those are the water quality tools.
I'm just gonna sit in a
please,
shorter chair.
Please do. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
But so all of the water quality data you're saying that's gonna end up in SEDM?
I don't know how it'll interface with SEDM.
Oh, I thought you just said you had a requirement.
We do have a requirement to interface with SEDM, and I don't know what that looks like yet. I've seen SEDM, and I don't really know how we'll interface with it.
SEDM is going through an amazingly rapid evolution right now.
Yeah.
So my guidance to you personally would not to be...
Just wait for a while.
I don't you think?
I would wait, yeah. And they're actually developing web services, so then once your data is in SEDM, it'll be accessible via web services that way as well. Just another thing.
Okay. Now it's all available. Just so you know, if you put it into SEDM, it's all available on opendata.com.
Yeah, so I'd love to be able to use these resources like you and like SEDM. And you know, my earlier discussion about the data being proprietary and wanting to sort of, keep it private for a while, it doesn't really extend to, like, other people I'm working with. It's more like putting it out in the public.
No, it makes sense. Sphere. It makes sense.
But for you guys, I have no concern.
But
you know,
see,
that's
SEDM
not
also
my concern.
Has what I was talking about is they call it temporary and permanent versus...
Yeah, yeah.
You
know, yeah.
Different. Versus public.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm looking forward to, like, moving farther along with this. Like I say, we've just scratched the surface for the past several months here. Mm-hmm. So that's the status of our water quality data, and I'm actually pretty pleased because now I can really work with it. And before, to work with it, we'd have to go through every individual shapefile and pull out the data frame and then merge those together, and it was a very tedious task. But now we have everything in one real database. I have to learn a little SQL SQL to be able to access that data more effectively.
I've read that both are appropriate.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I've been mocked for saying SQL. It almost makes me want to do more. You know? SQL. So, anyway, there's that. So let me show you where... Any other questions, then, about our ARC package? There's other implementations here. Mapping is the one we've looked at. We have ability for us, this is sort of internal, for creating new sites. adding our water quality data as we continue here, and then modifying records as we need to. And there's a separate package for running regressions. So the chlorophyll data that you get from the sond are a little notoriously unreliable. They're good for comparative stuff, but they don't really map directly onto the actual chlorophyll values. So we validate them by taking the water sample grabs, and we run a regression to correct the values in the sond. So we run a regression based on a few sick grab samples, and we have a package in here that does that for us automatically, which was previously an extraordinarily tedious process. Now it just runs it really quickly and then barfs out as a map. So
like,
we're
there's
really
already
pleased.
Those kind of correction tools available, and so I think it's fabulous that you have one, but on some of this stuff, it could save you time. Just somehow we have to figure out a
who
way.
Who has these correction tools?
Well, basically,
it's just a regression. Brian?
USGS, they were developed by these guys for USGS, and yeah. And they use it for their, John Bureau sensor network, and now Brian putting his optical sensors on top. But the general tool itself is slightly different. What you're talking, there's two parts of the correction, as you know. There's this part here where you're comparing it to the discrete, but then there's the part when you're looking at the data and you know that something just settled on your probe because
kind
of thing.
To clean it up.
So
we have that built into this too.
So you have the cleanup. Okay, because I say that's already been developed too.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, it's just basic data curating.
Yeah.
Looking for outliers and what. It's just a bit of R code that it runs. It's pretty quick and dirty, but it does the job.
Okay.
I will say that US just does a very good job of being very precise, gathering very precise data. The variability that we see between the sonds and the actual grabs is very small.
Well,
it's very minute.
And it's because of the spatial and temporal scale within which you're doing it, which is totally different than what they're trying to do.
Yeah, that's
broad,
right. Yeah, where you're looking at flux
wide
stuff.
Sensor
that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, we collaborate with USGS quite a lot, actually. So we know Brian and John, and we're doing work together in Sysumar. So we figure our analytical capacity will only improve. We're trying to find ways.
Is Dave on the phone listening, or do they?
No.
Can you explain the SlackTide project that's starting with turbidity?
I can't.
Oh. I'm going to try and explain it, but I'm going to botch it. And the point is that we're trying to get funding for this, and so I'm trying to figure out who all is interested in this tool. But essentially what happens now is when people, like you, go and do these things where you drag a sond, your distances are smaller, and so you can pretty much control for tide. You can move with the tide somewhat, but everybody has that challenge.
Yeah.
And so the challenge becomes when, for example, the Department of Water Resources is out there doing their turbidity trawls in the delta and trying to use those turbidity trawls to understand delta smelt movement and try to prevent, entrainment. It's seriously confounded by the fact that that what's going on with the tide. And so John Bureau is working with Dave Osti and with Karen Gertz. Karen wants to actually not have to do those trawls. She wants to be able to rely on the sensor network. And it's a safety issue because, of course, everyone wants the turbidity data when no one should
be out there
on the boat. But she also wants to free up that boat time to do other things. But she wants to be able to kind of compare apples to apples instead of apples to oranges. And everybody right now is sort of plagued by this apples to oranges thing.
That's right.
And so what John is doing is figuring out how to generate a picture that basically controls for the tide, because you're looking at it at a certain similar point in the tidal cycle, using already the algorithms that have been designed for extrapolating between every one of the existing sensors in the USGS and the DWR sensor network, so that then you actually can make some sense of it. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's incredibly valuable when I think of that. What I'd be interested in doing is tracking a bloom and trying to figure out where the bloom's coming from, when did the bloom start, when that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I am retiring, but I see incredible value in developing this tool, because it wouldn't just be for turbidity. You know, you could use it for any of these things that, you know, we're adding new sensors all the time in terms of what we can pick up.
Yeah,
we can do nitrate now, we're about to be able to do ammonium and stuff.
And you can see where it's moving.
And so how do you try to tidally average what you're looking at? So would that be valuable to you?
For that, we need a hydrodynamic model, and that's what we're working on. Mm-hmm. So for these water quality data, we're looking at... Hi, Peter. For these water quality data, we're looking at being able to put them into the water quality model and see, you know, how it's moving and what's going on. So, and presumably that would allow us to create a correction point for our analyses, so that we're analyzing the same swatch of water that occurs at the same spot at the same time. So we're not doing the apples to oranges kind of thing.
Okay.
We'll see how that handles. I mean, it's much more complicated than it sounds on paper.
It's very complicated.
And there's no satisfactory resolution that I know of it. I do know that the USG folks have been looking at figuring out, giving a numerical value for where on the tidal cycle you were sampling. And so you could put that number into an analysis
So that's parameterizing these algorithms.
Random variable.
And trying to visualize it.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to visualize it. Yeah, but the number would allow you to like sort of analyze it and compare and see how much the tidal... It would allow you to control that variability around the tidal cycle for a model. And for visualizing it, that'd be really cool to see.
So,
I don't know.
John, you're going to just hate me. So this is on my professional bucket list, is to get this project funded. When we actually get it drafted up more as like a scope of work, would you look at it and see if you think it adds value to what you're trying to do?
What,
this
Slack?
Idea of Slack water visualization tools.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
I think it'll only be like 6 pages.
Yeah, I'd love to look at it.
Okay.
I'm really interested. That'd
be
cool.
Because we're going to start it up there and then with the other USGS.
I'm a little skeptical. It's really ambitious, but we should start trying to do it. The fact is that we have like, you know, I think that might work on the main axis of the estuary. It's these little side channels and stuff that could be really daunting because they're just really hard to model.
You really need hard to model. Network. If you don't have the sensor
network, that would help a lot.
So that's the other reason it works.
Yeah.
In some of these other areas.
That's true.
But we think the broader sensor network is coming.
Yeah. Yeah, we're putting in a bunch of sensors ourselves. So we'll hopefully be part of it. Right now we're not really integrated very well, but hopefully that's coming.
Chlorophyll sensors?
Yeah.
Oh, so there's, just so you know, there's an effort going on right now, an intercalibration exercise for chlorophyll sensors, just to make sure that, you know, USGS sensors and DWR sensors and the Bay sensors
are reading
and stuff.
The same.
So they're just getting started on that now.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that Brian Bergamaschi is going to be the lead on it.
That's cool.
It's a Delta RMP project.
Yeah.
But right now they're kind of figuring out what to look for, and they've got a list of partners. I did not see UC Davis on it, list.
Okay,
but if you would be interested,
Yeah, we should. Yeah, especially because we're going to be working with those guys in both areas.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
You want to look what we're doing with the fish? This is just a database. Mm-hmm. This is just an access database. So we have a series of queries that we've set up on this.
I think it's really sad that everyone now starts with, well, it's just an access.
It's fancy enough.
It works, right?
Yeah.
And it's fancy enough.
So when we're thinking about fishes, we think about them in different ways. We have this is in process here. A zero catch basically means the fish that are captured plus their lengths plus all zero catches. That is fish trawls that you did that didn't catch fish, which you need to know how many trawls you executed for calculating effort. And we have effort built into these queries, so we can scale it pretty easily by our catch per unit of effort, which means that this could be used to rapidly generate visuals of any sort. So that's our zero catch. Zero catch with age is, I'm just going to run it. It takes a little while. It's just going to be data, beautiful data. So zero catch with age, we have collected enough fish for enough enough years that we can take our 35 years of data from Sassoon Marsh and see age classes. So we have, you know, we know a rough size for young of the year fish, for first years, often for second year, and then third year and above. And this is a really valuable tool, especially because we like to identify young of the year fishes. They're very much tied into the pelagic food web because they're feeding largely on invertebrate resources like zooplankton, and then later on in their life on epibenthic invertebrates. So identifying that vulnerable first year of the fish is really useful for us in terms of understanding the nursery potential of places like Sassoon Marsh and even to a lesser degree Cash and Lindsay.
So you've made basically your own race by length at date using the Sassoon Marsh data.
Which is appropriate because it's a regional
that's
data.
Really cool. So it's, how does it compare to the delta length at date criteria that they use, as well as the
that's just for salmon. We've done it. We haven't done it for salmon.
You haven't done it for salmon
because we don't catch that many salmon. We've only done it for a few species. Okay. We've done it for shad, for striped bass, for split tail, for some of the gobies, for the sculpin, for tule perch. I think those are the basics ones.
Okay.
Can I go back? This is just bare of little brain thing. So the way that you generate that is that you expect that relationship to vary based on environmental quality, so from year to year. But by having done this for so many years, you're able to...
Yeah, and what you see is if you put together as a histogram, a bar histogram, you see these humps. So you've got, you know, this is on this axis is size, length in millimeters, and then this axis is counts, right? And so you'll see these, for young of the year, you'll see a sort of normal distribution of bars, and the highest point, you know, that middle point, centroid, is, you know, where we assume the average is for young of the year fish, or first year or second year, and we'll see that bump for, you know, young of the year, first year, second year, and then we... it has to be corrected for, because we know that they're growing each month, right? So we essentially we track the young of the year over time, and so we're pulling out how to describe this. So we get this sort of normal curve, but we've corrected for month so that we know that those fish are glomming into that.
Kind of like what Hobbs does with when he's doing
his otoliths. Yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah. So, and this is part of Amber's work too that she never published. So we'll get that signal and we'll say, okay, well, that's it. And then we'll sort of parameterize it. Rather than taking a mean, we'll say fish between this length and this length, just like with salmon, are going to be young of the year split tail. And so we assign them that age. And like I say, that's a whole different analysis than if we were to just do all the fish that we caught by raw numbers, right? It wouldn't be very... I mean, that's valuable in a way because we can kind of track things, but it's really powerful to be able to look at the different year classes. Yet you can see when you had a really big recruitment one year, and you can look at, you know, so say we look at this year and we have like a, you know, a giant recruitment of split tail from last year, and then the 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds are very, very sparse, and we can say, oh, well, you know, there was a drought. They didn't get a chance to have an effective spawn off. But this year, we have a lot of potential. Or if you see a year where there was very few recruitment, but there were lots of adults, you go, well, okay, that was an example where we had a poor spawning event. You know, so you can look at each year in this sort of trend and see, try to compare how environmental conditions are supporting or not supporting recruitment to the young of the year stage, and then advancing through through subsequent stages. This is a basic kind of population dynamics.
But the only reason you're able to do that is because of the length of your data set.
Yeah. Yeah, you get enough data and it sort of pulls out. So other people have been able to do it with shorter data sets, shorter time series of data sets by sacrificing the fish and pulling out the year stones. the odorless like Hobbs does. And then aging them that way. And, you know, that would be a great way to validate these data, but we have so much.
You have so much.
And the you know, the distributions show up so clearly. It doesn't work if there's not enough growth. So, you know, so if, you know, on the right side of this age, right side of the length plot, it starts to blur and get muddy because the growth is slowing down. So we can't really say. But for most of the fish, we can get young of the year in the first years.
Thank you.
So it's just that really that young of the year is probably the most valuable tool. Again, because we think that young of the year, and particularly in Sassoon Marsh, not so much in Cache Lindsay, young of the year really use those resources. Cache Lindsay's not so much a nursery as it is like maybe a fall refuge, fall feeding ground for some of the migratory fishes. I haven't quite figured it out. But anyway, I'm working on it. So anyway, that's what those do. And then and that gives, you know, those particular queries give us length as well. So if you want just raw numbers though, we have these cross tabs. This gives you a different way of viewing the data as raw numbers. Thinking, definitely thinking. This is takes a while to run through the data for this. The cross tab are really nice for visualizing because then you can just look at numbers of fish. But if you want to do like a length analysis, then you have to use the other data. And the nice thing is, maybe it'll show you in a second here. The reason it's taking so long is because it's calculating effort for every sample as well as the number of fish and assigning an age for them, and it's sort of doing this on the fly. There we go. So station code, sample year, the duration of the tow gives us sample time, gives us the water quality variables, and here we have effort in minutes. Here we have all the water quality data that we collected at the same time. We have a veg list of, you know, the vegetation that was in the area that we trawled through or that we captured in the trawl. We have a list of the invertebrates that we caught, a tally of native to non-native fishes. The CPUE is calculated for both natives, non-natives, and overall. And then we have individual fishes so each row, I should say, is a trawl. And so it calculates the total number of fishes by age class where available. And so that's really easy to plot up. You can grab that whole row and then, you know, manipulate it however you want to kind of demonstrate that. And you can do that over a series of months quite easily, if that makes sense. So the difference between this one and the other one, and they're both valuable, is that this one shows you the row, it's a repeated rows. It's a long style format.
So it's like one spreadsheet. Fish per row.
Yeah, it's one fish per row exactly,
and that's
with
how
the length.
You show the
so
length.
It gives you. It's very repetitive, but it's the only way to show the mm-hmm. length. And we just we include all the water quality data on this because people might want that, you know, in tandem. But in many ways, because the age class is already calculated on this is really what we want. That's sort of the go-to thing. And certainly the easiest for plotting and for a lot of analyses we do as well. So, and then we have species caught, species not caught. We have our zooplankton data in here as well.
Can I see the zooplankton data format?
Sure. This is our raw... sort of raw stored data.
Can you see it or should I check?
I can see it.
This is
Is it like it? So it's like
sample,
a matrix format then, almost with zeros and
species by date.
And then are those mm-hmm. counts of species?
These
or
are counts.
Okay.
This is the aliquot. So we subsample the samples that we take in order mm-hmm. to count them. We take aliquot subsamples.
Okay.
And that's the fraction that was taken here. And then we have numbers that were taken in that fraction. So this is aliquot. This particular sample, BK1-11-13-2012, had three aliquots taken until we got sufficient numbers of bugs to you have to count probably 100 to 200 of each of the major species to have reliable counts. Otherwise, your error is too great, right? You're not really counting anything. So after three aliquots, we were able to get sufficient numbers of bugs.
Okay.
And then the way you calculate, then you go from that to multiplying by the inverse, dividing by the inverse of the fraction that you caught to give you total number per
sample.
Zooplankton trawl or sample, yeah. And then you divide that by the meters, the cubic meters of water sample. And that we did that for, we kind of built that into the database as well. So these are the calculated numbers, the estimated numbers.
And then you're separating by life stage, right?
We do copepodites, which are the juveniles, and the adults for some of the large ones. We do gravid females for the egg-carrying ones. So we do that for Pseudodiaphthimus and Urethemera. Limnithona, we just have adults, and gravid females, and all the others, we just have adults.
Okay.
I should say there's some, like Acartiella, I guess we're doing copepodites as well. But most of the others we aren't. So I have... Yeah, we don't usually do the Nauplii, which are the little babies, because it's extremely time-consuming. I have a study, but that didn't require a database.
Can you speciate the copepods at the Nauplii stage?
Wow. That was my original research in my master's degree with Wim. I did that to try to calculate. Yeah, but I have several pairs of glasses and a fake eye, bionic eye. Yeah, so that I still have to publish that paper. It's a really cool paper. But yeah, we looked at mortality rates across the Delta, and we found that mortality of the Nauplii was much higher in Suisun Bay than it was in the Delta. And we hypothesized that's due to clam predation. And so that was the original place where we got the idea that export of phytoplankton might not be an effective way to support food webs in the Delta, but export of zooplankton at the adult stage might be. Because we hypothesized that the adult zooplankton in Suisun Bay are not produced in situ, that they're being exported from Suisun Marsh or from the Delta as juveniles and adults, because the babies, they're not able to successfully reproduce in Suisun Bay because of clam predation or because of competition with the clams. There's just not enough food. Whereas in the Delta, there's food, and Suisun Bay Marsh, there's food, just because the Potamocorbula, the really aggressive clam, is just not there. So I still haven't published that up. There's a really cool piece that we did together, and I got to write it up. Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
You need to be
like, I did it.
Tower, young
I
man.
Did it. You can actually identify, you can actually speciate many of the Nauplii.
Wow.
It was a pretty painful process.
That's pretty impressive, John.
So you don't need a database for that, though, because you won't never generate enough data to put it in anything other than an Excel spreadsheet. It's really, I did a few samples and tried to extrapolate big things from it. So, okay, that's what I've got. Like I said, we also have bathymetry data, and we'll soon have a hydrodynamic model running off of that, and I don't know how we're going to prepackage that.
Can you pull out to your map and show me the boundary layers of your bathymetry model that Phil's developing? Just, again, this is, sorry. Never mind, you don't have to do that. I told you I was going
to
stop.
I should be able to show you the bathymetry, but I have to find it first.
Is it restricted to the Cashlu complex?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're larger. Maybe we want it to shag a little bit. Let me see.
Not a legitimate question for this meeting.
I have a question for you that I should have asked when I first came in. So I had problems parking, and I remember that Jenna told me when I came here with her before that actually with a state plate that I could park somewhere.
Anywhere?
In some other place. So it took me a while to find it, but it seems like
it was legit. Is your plate a Diamond E?
I don't know what that is.
Is it the EX?
It's the E and the diamond, and so there are a whole sets of parking areas that are labeled like diamond E. That's where you get to park.
At least when I worked for the
state. You just parked out here?
Yeah. I mean, because I drove around and around and tried the visitor parking.
I can't imagine they're going to ticket a state vehicle, but I don't know.
Well, I found something online that said state and such vehicles are exempt
from
certain things, but I was in such a rush. Yeah. I just okay.
If you get a ticket, just protest it.
Well, the state will pay it. It's not going to be me.
That's true.
I won't even see it, hopefully.
No, you'll see it on your dash.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway. But I think that's when I came here last time with Jenna that we just
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. When you think about working at different states, you have to pay your own parking tickets at the water board.
Oh, well, great.
Just so you know. So
I got
apparently not.
I don't know. I've never gotten a ticket.
But I had actually paid for it. I just put my parking pass upside down on my dashboard.
Yeah, so that's where we're at. And yeah, I welcome any feedback or suggestions. You know, I think I'm at the end of my working with these fellows who have cobbled this together with me, except for putting on sort of finishing touches, like the access database is just exactly what I need at this point. And I think that, you know, for a scientist, you know, we can just give them the database and they can have at it. They'll know what to do with it. We've made it accessible enough if they can do anything with it. You know, visualizing those data, like consistently with CDFW's great website where they have the dot plots or the
You mean the trawl data,
the pie graphs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be a great thing to think about, but we only have it for a few years, you know.
We've started doing some of that with the new EDSM monitoring stuff as well.
So I don't know how valuable that is in the grand scheme of things. Presumably, if you know, it'd be really great to do it in Sassoon Marsh, where we have 37 years of data and we're slated to collect another 10. You know, that's a really valuable resource that's not really out there as much as the other agency data that are out there. And then the water quality data that we have, I think could potentially have a web interface directly off of our server, and I don't know, I'm going to think about that later, you know, unless you come up with brilliant ideas, you know, or you know, the state has requirements. But right now, the data are in a place where I can use them and finish my report and start writing up papers and stuff and generating images from them. And that, for me, is where I want it. And how much further we take it depends on how much I'm goaded.
So
yeah,
this is the way the fish data is set up now. Yeah. And so the thing that's really nice about this in terms of generating figures, as you know, as fish, it's like, you know, you get a zillion of them or you get nothing, is you can turn off species here so that if something's dominating it, you know, you can look at the other stuff. But all of this kind of data, you can go and, you know, basically by touching anything, you can pull it in. It's actually pretty amazing because of what's needed for the biops. And Matt DeCar pretty much designed this before he left.
Really?
But okay. Because they're so interested in, because they're dealing with such broader water bodies than you are. I mean, he's got it laid out so that it actually has, when you were moving across, showing, you know, your different columns in terms of like when you trawled and you didn't catch, all that kind of stuff. All that is easily visualized with these tools. And in fact, what Matt has is, you know, the whole thing with the smelt cam and Delta smelt surfing and all that kind of stuff. What you can do now with Matt's data is you can actually see the different runs and what so at a site. So just know that that's all been developed. So in this case, this is actually the dashboard for making some of the operations decisions. So it's really focused on the fish. In this case, there's RPAs, and so data is summarized whether or not, you know, what's going on in terms of like the screw traps in the upper river, whether or not you're good to go or not. But again, you can look at the number, and if it's zero, of course, what you want to know is, you know, how many hauls did they do, all that kind of stuff, or how long did they trawl. And so all that kind of stuff is actually available now.
A useful one would probably be the DJ FMP details tab. That shows, we have a graph that does effort versus catch on two axes, mm-hmm. so you can see the actual volume of water sampled, mm-hmm. and
oh, cool.
so that
uh-huh.
helps with, instead of just a CPUE of zero, you can see like how long they trawled for and volume
right.
of water they sampled.
Yeah.
And so
then it's by region.
It's much better if you're not looking at it on an iPad, because what you need to do is here, what you can do is visually line up. If you've got it on your screen there,
mm-hmm.
you know exactly where you are in terms of this whole tide issue, because as you know, IEP doesn't control the tides. But then you can, again, you can go down and you get the catch volume and you get down. Well, this one, maybe it's just because it's on my iPad. I know what you're talking about. I don't have that. But there's an incredible amount of detail that's available just because of what had to be developed for operations.
Yeah, right.
Could serve you because it's already been developed. So
yeah, it seems like if we can find a way to get it to the interface and talk to our data, essentially, or our data to.
And so that's what it is. So Carly will take your data and put it behind a very carefully password-protected place. But then she
yeah,
can
not, yeah, you know, I am not worried about
okay.
that, actually.
Okay.
In spite of our earlier conversation,
okay.
I'm much less paranoid than you think.
Okay, well, because I have beat it into them. You have to be so sensitive to the data requirements
now,
of the data owner.
I really was just talking about, I'm really happy to work with anyone.
Okay.
I'm not that way.
Okay.
All I was saying, really, and I just want to reiterate this real quick, I'm not ready for it to go prime time, you know.
Okay.
I don't want it to be out for the public yet. I want to collaborate with people to produce good work, and so that's what my data are for. And I want to be, as long as I'm part of that process,
mm-hmm.
then that's great.
Okay.
That's what I want to do.
So here's the question. Are you okay with us playing with your data and with the data that was collected
fully.
By other folks within our cache collaborative and then showing our cache collaborative?
Yeah, that would be super. Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be great. Absolutely. I'm totally into that. Okay.
And are you okay 5 years from now when I want an update on all this stuff because I've been retired, I can grab you when I see you walking down E Street and say, John, what's up?
I'm okay with that.
Okay. And my work is done here.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea because I'm not trained for any of this sort of, you know, mass scale, right? That's why we're pulling in experts, you know, trying to talk to different studies. You know, my idea of my training is like looking at sites and studies and trying to see what's happening on a sort of localized scale, and it's hard to scale up. It's hard for everyone to scale up.
You know what got me in all of this is when I first started at SWIFCA, one of my first assignments is every year there's an annual review of the biological opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like my first week, and it was one of their annual reviews, and it was 2 days of every 15 minutes kind of going RPA by RPA and people putting up their data whether or not the RPA had been met. And after a day and a half, I was just like, oh my God. And then John Bureau got up at the end of the second day and he was just starting working with you guys on these visualization tools. And he gave this presentation, and it was one of the first times people were showing that you really have to be thinking about tides when you're trying to interpret this fish data.
Right.
And he had just these beautiful visualizations.
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, I totally got it.
Mm-hmm.
But what was more important to me was looking at people and all the managers that were there who rarely see this data, but because it's an external reviewer there, they all got it. And so that when you're trying to take all this complexity and you're trying to influence a management decision,
mm-hmm.
it's just like there were aha moments and to me.
Yeah,
it was like, where as a scientist, I'm just too geeky to ever explain something to an agency director in a way that I can keep their attention because the nuances of the data are just so interesting and exciting
mm-hmm.
that to me this is a communication tool to affect fish restoration.
Yeah, that's right.
So I've seen it work a number of times when the more detailed stuff that would make you get all excited and want to dig in doesn't pass muster with those folks.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's true.
So,
it's true. Being able to communicate this stuff in an effective way is so powerful.
And so the reason that I like these tools is because you can dig in, that, you know, I can show it to Chuck Bonham or Bill Croyle at that high level, with the 30 seconds you get with one of them, but somebody like a Matt Dekar can dig into that by just kind of clicking through to see, okay, so all those fish, even though they were at this site, mm-hmm. were all at the margins. Nobody was mid-channel, kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
So, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah,
right. Hope this is useful.
This is really helpful.
So do you have contact information for Nick that you could, is that his name?
Santos, yeah.
That you could pass on?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And we can coordinate on terms of how to port things over and mm-hmm. so you can play around with it. That'd be super.
When is the actual contract with these guys end?
So we just extended through May.
Okay.
Yes, for the report.
Just for the report.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We have to get an updated fact sheet for the website.
You'll get that too.
So.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's on my list of or that was somewhere, some email or
somebody
my
sent
contract
it to you.
Or something. Yeah,
yeah,
I saw that. Yeah.
I think it's much
it should be easier than the first one you did.
Make sure data.
What made me notice it is that I was rereading Wim and Brian.
Oh, it still has the
and it's all the stuff
the
that we were going to do that failed.
It's really changed.
Yeah.
That was
we didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was wild. That was a wild study. That was really difficult.
Yeah.
Gizmos.
Cool.
All right.
Get out of your hair.
Thanks for hosting us.
Yeah, thanks for coming over. Sorry we had to squeeze in a little box here, but we'll work pretty well.
Yeah.